KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org. This is your radio call numbers, these letters to listen to the Health and Happiness Hour. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. The Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association supports the presentation of this show as we deal with matters of health, mental health, physical health, social health, and all health and happiness in general. We thank Bob Wall, our radio engineer, for making all matters technical come together. Now, Dr. Suzanne introduces today's topic and presenters.
During Indigenous Peoples Week, we report from Leah Wang's research that in 2019, the latest year for which we have data, there were over 10,000 Native people locked up in local jails. Although this population has fluctuated, the Native jail population is up a shocking 85% since 2000. And these figures don't even include those held in Indian country jails, which are located on tribal lands. The number of people in Indian country jails increased by 61% between 2000 and 2018. In Montana, we hear from the Montana Innocence Project, Indigenous peoples make up only 6% of the state's population, yet over 30% of the women's prison inmates are Indigenous. The criminalization of survival is one issue that contributes to this disproportionate incarceration. Well, what is that? What is the criminalization of survival? Native rights activist Lori Little Dog said there are many social factors that create a situation in which Indigenous women are in survival mode at all times. Lack of access to employment, transportation, education, and stable child care are just some of the factors that lead to behaviors that are criminalized. From the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, criminalizing survivors of domestic violence, sexual abuse, and trafficking for doing what they need to do to survive is not justice. And the justice system must instead provide women access to services and treatment that will allow them to escape the abuse to prison pipeline once and for all. The incarceration of Indigenous women has another unique consequence. Because most incarcerated women are moms, removing them from their home and the community can be more problematic than the behavior the woman was arrested or convicted for. What about the children? How do we begin to combat this ongoing tragedy? Form a committee? Set up a well-paid task force to study the issue? Please, no. Today's guests are taking personal action to address this issue. Let's welcome Lori Walker of Bozeman Health, who has scheduled an evening to educate our community on this issue. Thank you for doing that, Laura. And we also welcome Karma Corcoran, author, speaker, and practitioner of a therapy method that directly targets our Native American sisters with ways to cope and succeed. Welcome, ladies. I can't tell you how important we feel this issue is for our community and for Montana. Lori, Thank you for bringing Karma on board, and welcome to the show this evening.
Thank you. I want to say, first of all, thank you to my friend, Dr. Lori Walker, for inviting me to Bozeman, for coordinating this incredible evening that's going to happen, and also for you for having us on today.
Well, it's just an honor to have you, and having read your book and seen your work, we're very, very fortunate to have you, and Lori has been highly instrumental in setting this up. You're so correct. Lori, are you still there?
Yeah, I just wanted to give a little background for the event and why we're holding it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. Part of why we're hosting this event is it's a component of our community benefit work for the hospital. We have a community health improvement plan that is rooted in data from the community that identified injury and violence prevention as one of the areas they'd like us to address. And so we try to host events like this to raise awareness, reduce stigma, provide resources, and promote domestic violence prevention. We have a partnership with organizations like our local intimate partner violence shelter called Haven and Native American Studies at Montana State University for this event to provide education and to build our community's capacity to respond to and prevent violence from occurring. And we thought Dr. Corcoran's work was the best work we had to bring forward to lead our community from here.
We truly appreciate that. And Arliss serves on the board of the help center that provides that particular help we would need in these instances. So we're very, very supportive of all of this effort, and thank you all for it very much. And we thank Bozeman Health. They've been a real pillar of the community, and we look forward to hearing more about the upcoming events they have scheduled and planned. I was wondering, Karma, if you could sort of tell us how you came to be interested in your work and describe your work and kind of fill us in on how it began and where you are now.
Thank you. And I'm actually going to introduce myself in the traditional way. It's traditional for us to let people know who we are and who our people are. So I'm Dr. Karma Corcoran. I'm an enrolled citizen of the Chippewa Cree Nation. My great-great-grandfather is Chief Big Bear. My great-grandfather is Chief Little Bear, and Open Eyes Little Bear is my grandmother. And, you know, my family, like almost every Native American family, has been touched by incarceration. And incarceration runs deeply through the generations of our families. And it's something that has caused and continues to cause great pain, trauma, and suffering. And as you spoke of in, you know, your introduction, mothers, children, families, community, fathers, all suffer when a member of their family is incarcerated. So when I was doing my PhD work, you know, one starts a PhD and has really big ideas. And then, you know, you realize that you've got to narrow it down and narrow it down and narrow it down to what is it that you really want to say? What is it that you really want to address? And while incarceration itself for Native Americans was my overall issue, I realized that I needed to concentrate on women. And there were a couple reasons for that. One was that I was able to do a workshop at the women's prison, which there's just one of here in Oregon. And so I had been volunteering as part of a group for a number of years, and now I was going to be able to lead a workshop there using general action theory. And then the other was that when it comes to certain aspects of healing, it would be inappropriate for me to do that with members of the opposite sex. Certainly, Cree people are gendered in what we feel should and can be discussed between genders. And so I was just really lucky to be able to continue at the women's prison. And for me, so many of my family, certainly including myself, had family members who were or are incarcerated. And another huge motivation for me was that incarceration is deep in the generation. So a very large amount of my nieces and nephews have been incarcerated. A very large proportion of their children have been incarcerated, who of course are now mothers, fathers, and even grandparents themselves. And now this next generation is involved in the juvenile justice system of Montana and other parts of the United States, but where most of my family still lives in Montana. Mm-hmm. And of course, some of them have children themselves. And I just thought, we have got to do something. We are not doing enough. And that we have to do better. And so that's what really brought me to writing the book, to doing workshops, speaking engagements, consulting. And I do feel very fortunate to be able to carry on the work of the book. And so here we are.
I think the ones that are fortunate are those who are benefiting from your work and from the book, because there's a real fallout from the justice system inequities. I'm noting now that the suicide rate for females is 5 per 100,000. But for Native American women, that same rate is 35 per 100,000, yeah, which is 7 times higher. So there's a real cost to ignoring this problem, and I'm so proud that you are proud of you, that you're taking these steps to try to do something about it. Very proud of that, Karma. And I noted that you have come up with a particular method that seems to be very helpful. And could you talk to us a little bit, perhaps, about how you go about this?
Sure. So, first of all, culture is the answer for Native American people. Culture is always the answer. But when I began really immersing myself in my family history, the history of my people, the Chippewa Cree, much less, you know, tribes across the country. And incarceration rates, as you said, continue to rise. Then I had to say, we're not doing enough, and we're not doing things in a way that it can be received. And I was so fortunate in the coursework for my dissertation to have a wonderful professor, F. David Peet, and I took a class from him and was exposed to gentle action theory. And I also really got to know him. I did an independent study project with him, and it turned out that he was my committee chair, and which is really an important position for students.
Been there, done that. It certainly is.
And so he had actually written a book called Blackfoot Physics. F. David Peet was a physicist. He was a theoretical physicist. And so he spent a lot of time with the Blackfoot people and First Nations people. And so he understood me and validated my cultural and spiritual beliefs. And I looked at gentle action theory and I compared it to traditional ways of knowing and being for Native American people. There were tenets of it that truly were reflected in both aspects. And for me, the most important part of gentle action theory was that it should come within the society. So for me, when I was looking at the issues of Native American people and realizing that we have had terrible experiences of outsiders coming in and telling us our problems, in their views, what we should do about these problems, and oftentimes offering maybe a small stipend for some research, but then never coming back to community and disseminating that research. Also, there's definitely been a lack of really explanation and understanding sometimes of what you are doing when you sign a release. And so people come in, you know, they share their stories, their wants, their needs for community, and then researchers are never heard from again. Another aspect of that is that that research then becomes the property of whoever the researcher is. And so the researcher can go on to, you know, apply for grants or publish a book or do all sorts of different things. And this is people's life story. And they no longer even own that anymore. And so that was really troublesome to me. And so with gentle action theory, instead, it's about building relationship. It's about the people themselves saying, you know, this is what's important to us. This is what we need to be thinking about. And so I was able to do a workshop out of the prison using gentle action theory. And so here's an example. I think we've all been to conferences or workshops where we go for the day and, you know, we discuss a societal or global issue. We might have speakers and breakout groups, and we might have some, you know, little exercise where we address the issue. And then after a full day, you know, we've come up with maybe some possible things, or, you know, allegedly we've solved world hunger. I've not seen that actually happen. And then we go away. With gentle action theory, there's this understanding, first of all, that we need to take time. And also, there has to be trust and relationship. And so if you're an outsider coming in, that you've got to take the time to get to know the group that you're working with. You have got to take the time to build that trust and relationship, and that you yourself have to be incredibly trustworthy. And when an issue is addressed in that way, first of all, those involved in working on the issue are able to have an authentic perception of what's going on. What is the societal issue? What are the problems that are happening because of it? What are the needs? What's the desired outcome to address the issue? And then also, as we work through, what are the resources available? And how are we going about doing something so that it is sensitive, it's creative, it's flexible, it meets the needs, and that it's done in a way that those that are involved in the issue can receive it and participate in different ways. And so it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. And when you bring in the cultural aspect for a Native American group, where you are calling upon your elders, you're calling upon ceremony, you're calling upon ancestral knowledge to address this contemporary issue, you then are able to do it in a way that is guided by Creator and the ancestors.
And I wanted to ask, make sure I'm understanding, because I understood this was on a personal basis, that it's individualized and that each person gets to ask and answer these questions, or a small group. Is that how it works, Karma?
It can work both ways. So it can be, for example, the beginnings can be a large gathering. So, for example, I'm very fortunate to be speaking a lot of places since the book came out. And recently I spoke at a tribal gathering, and, you know, the issues that they're really looking at is issues of children and issues of incarceration. So they've identified this is an issue for their people. There's a lot of children whose parent or guardian or someone in their family is incarcerated. What do we do to meet those children's needs? And part of that work will be involved asking the children instead of saying, well, they need this and that and the other thing. We know some of their needs, but we need to hear from those children too. It can also be done on an individual basis. For example, I mentor a number of women And some of the women I mentor, you know, I've mentored for over 15 years. Some of them, you know, I don't hear from very often. You know, maybe they touch base with me to, you know, share something great. They've started college or they've had a baby or gotten married. Others, and recently I have three that have circled back to me that have some deep and pressing needs. And so to be able to approach their needs and my working with them using general action theory. So instead of my saying things like, okay, today you need to do this, that, and the other thing. And no, you can't do that. That wouldn't be right. Instead, it's what is that you're needing right now? What is it that you're wanting to move toward? Can I help you by advocating for you, by sourcing some resources for you? Now, it's not up to me to call those resources. It's up to them. And then to help them as they continue to move forward, whether it's addressing legal issues, child custody, housing, need to go into rehab, whatever that may be, it's about me helping them to create the life that they want to have. But it's also about being truthful in, is that a good decision? How do you feel about that? Is that a safe place for you to be? You know, that's been a problem for you in the past. How are you thinking you're going to address this? And so it is not dogmatic. It is not in any way, shape, or form authoritarian. Instead, it's about them and them building their skills, gathering their resources, and most of all, moving toward that place of healing. Because anyone that I mentor that's been incarcerated, they all need healing. You know, and some of them are very far along that journey and they've done amazing things. Others, there's still some deep healing that needs to happen from things past and unfortunately often things present. So yes, it can be done in workshops, in consulting and helping a tribal group set up a general action theory, traditional ways program. And then, of course, working with individuals also.
And I assume...
It's a lot.
Yeah. Whoa, it is. I assume you practice follow-up. Like, you don't just make the suggestions. You get to spend some time to follow up on these needs and aspirations.
Follow-up is key. And whether you're in a tribal setting where you are working on the issue with participants, that's part of the being trustworthy part, is that you have got to follow up. And that takes time. And it also means that you might have to call, email, message, text, whatever the means is. But something that I learned, which I already knew, but was reinforced for me doing the workshop at the women's prison, in the follow-up comments at the end was things like, you came every single week. We could always count on you. And they knew when they got out that they could call me. If I said, I'll mentor you when you get out, I would never say that unless I meant it. So as I said, some of these women, I've been involved in the honor and privilege of being their mentor for over 15 years.
That's so impressive. And I think what Arliss is always talking about is the relationship is the most significant part of this in any change, and is the best predictor.
I wanted to ask, among the women's indigenous populations, is there a difference among the geographical areas where indigenous populations live? For example, is there more of a negative effect on the culture, let's say in Oklahoma versus Oregon versus the Southwest? Like, I was thinking there might be more supportive environments in one place rather than another. Is it pretty generally fragmented as with the negative aspects, as you've mentioned?
It's very fragmented, and certainly anywhere there's a reservation, the need is great. Also, that obviously where there are large urban populations, the need is great. The societal issues do not go away when somebody, you know, moves to a large urban center. And even here in Portland, we have a wonderful, large, urban Native population. And we have some great Native American nonprofits. However, the issue of incarceration, those other societal issues that you all brought up earlier, such as domestic violence, sexual assault, trafficking. Here in Oregon, I-5 runs, you know, from the south up through California, you know, Oregon, Washington, and on. And it's a highway for trafficking of Native American indigenous women.
We can underline that. We had the lead DEA agent, Stacy Zinn, with us last week, and she talked exactly about what you're saying to deal with sex trafficking and drugs. And yes, it's a big concern, and goes through Montana and Oregon along with every other state.
Well, North Dakota, you think about the man camps. You know, it's just a huge problem. And so it's a problem that we can't think of as geographical. Instead, we have to look at it as that community. So, for example, you know, there's 9 reservations in Oregon. There, I can't remember how many there are in Montana. I'm from Rocky Boys. And then certainly large urban populations of Native Americans, certainly Great Falls, Billings. And so it's just a societal issue. And we just have to address those things that are going on in each of these communities.
I was wondering, too, in all of your work and these many years you've spent, have you been able to, it sounds like you've been so busy just doing the work and doing the actual one-on-one work and group work, but have you been able to set up any research on the outcomes of gentle action therapy and kind of measure if, you know, what the differences might be? I mean, it could be there obvious without that, but I just wondered if there was also a research component to this.
Well, here's what I say. Somebody younger than me needs to do that. And it's needed. I am a theoretical philosopher. However, so much is needed from a quantitative aspect. And it would serve us well if somebody would do that. Now, the difficult part is this. When someone is in prison, obviously they're very easy to track, you know, right where they are. When they get out of prison, generally speaking, they are paroled to wherever their crime was committed. If you've developed a relationship that carries forward when they're out of prison and you can mentor them, you would be able to get the quantitative mm-hmm. data.
Mm-hmm.
If you mm-hmm. don't, you know, you would not be able, the only thing you'd be able to track would be recidivism. You know, did they yes. go back in either, you know, in the state that you last knew them to be, or, you know, people go on to commit crimes in other states, too.
Yes.
So
yes.
that aspect would be very valuable
yes.
to have. And certainly I think that as far as grants or things like that, if one was going to go that route to support the work, I think that you'd probably need more of that.
Mm-hmm.
Irma, do you have a sense of your anecdotal outcomes now with the women that you've worked with over the years? Are their recidivism rates lower?
Incredibly low. Out of 12 women, let's see, out of 12, three have gone back in. One, unfortunately, died in prison, which is just a heartbreaker for me. She was really a strong individual, but she could not get away from the pull of a lifestyle selling and using drugs. And she knew what would happen, you know, and we talked about it, that she did not want to, you know, die in prison, die a junkie. She didn't want to hurt her mother that way. But unfortunately, she was very, very successful at dealing drugs. And so she ended up getting caught, going back in, and ultimately losing her life.
Well, they make so much money that it's very alluring because you can step in and make a lot of money.
Oh, in no time at all. I mean, you know, and one thing I will always appreciate about this young woman, and I won't use her name just for the protection of her family, is that she never lied to me, ever. You know, and she really wanted this different life. She just wasn't able to get there in time. And, you know, I'll mourn her forever. And it's just, you know, it's just too bad, too.
And I attribute her death to the drug cartels, yeah.
You know, that one can make such a living, you know, doing that.
Well, I'm reading that a systematic review of recidivism rates among the general population could be up to 60%. So you only had 30% of those working with you, which I think shows a really terrific improvement.
I think so, too. You know, and like I said, it's really about, it's about the method. It's about paying them respect, helping them to define what they want and how they want to get there, as opposed to me telling them, you have to do this and that. And I think that it helps with the success rate when, for some of these women, nobody's ever believed in them before. And that's a huge thing. If nobody has ever thought something positive about you. And I hear that all the time.
Arliss has a psychologist of old, Yuri Bronfenbrenner. Tell us about that, honey.
Yeah, years ago, Yuri Bronfenbrenner, a child developmental psychologist, said that a key to a good life is that each child would have someone who's crazy about him or her. And it sounds like that you developed that kind of relationship.
I used to teach at University of Oregon in their social work program. And so he was, you know, he was the one that we, you know, used his methods and his research. And I think that really is part of it. You know, I had one of the women tell me recently who is still working hard to really have the life that she wants. She, you know, got out. The first year was rocky, but I would text her in Messenger all the time. I would see on Facebook what she was up to, and I just say, don't forget to call me. You know, you can always message me. And it took a year. And then she circled back to me and said, you know, I'm done. This is what I need to do. And so we developed a plan, and then she had a surprise with a new baby coming into the world. But she messaged me recently, and it touched my heart because she said thank you for some things that I had helped to arrange. And most of all, she said thank you for the validation and being non-judgmental.
I absolutely love
really
that story.
Easy to say. Yeah. Oh my gosh, you really screwed up this time.
I wanted to ask you too.
I'm a mother, you know.
Well, exactly. I wanted to ask you, Karma, also, it might not even be possible, but there are many people who are not Native American or maybe were not raised, even though they have that history as one. And how would you advise them if they wanted to volunteer or help or, you know, seek out Native Americans on the reservation, which we have so many here in Montana and so many
right.
needs. And so what is a way to gain their confidence and do it, you know, straight up and straightforwardly and let them know you're there to help and not be threatening or too un-Native American, if you will. How could we interact in a very effective manner?
So, you know, I really have some suggestions. One is to always be respectful. There's a great difference between being an ally and overstepping the cultural boundaries, which, as we are all aware, has happened way too much to Native people. And so what I encourage people to do is look who's seeing the work, who's doing the work in your area, and, you know, volunteer with them. Also, if there are Native groups in your area, for example, as I shared in Portland, you know, we have 3 or 4 really large Native American social service agencies. You know, go in and interview them and volunteer and say, this is what I'd like to do. Is there a place for me? And then be open to the training. You know, I don't think that anybody should go near anybody before they have some training, native or non-native. You know,
sure.
People need to have vicarious trauma training. And then also, there's such a need in juvenile justice. And juvenile justice is filled with everybody's children. And I have friends that go in and they cook a meal once a month at a juvenile justice place. And they just go in, they make this fabulous meal. I mean, it can be macaroni and cheese and sliced ham. You know, it doesn't have to be a five-star dinner. And then they're just there. They're there to interact. They take the time for these young people to get to know them. And before long, they're looking forward to it. I worked at a nonprofit in Oregon for a number of years that we served women and children fleeing domestic violence. And we had two couples that at least once or twice a month came in and cooked. And so they would make these meals. And then in the evening, we would often have, you know, arts and crafts time or whatever, story time. And they would join in with these. And they would be really following the women and children's needs of, you know, not being too intrusive. And before long, especially certain women are just wanting to share the foods of their culture. And so they're cooking with these families, you know, and we're eating great food, I might add,
yeah,
too. And even though it was a women's and children's center, we had men that came in and volunteered. And so these couples coming in together were also a very gentle way of showing that, yes, there can be respectful, loving relationships. And believe me, they went through 30 hours of training to come in and volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so valuable.
Wow.
And so I really encourage people to also be innovative. One of the things I did with this group when I first started, there was about 50 volunteers and they were moving to this larger facility. So I invited the 50 in and asked, what do you see that we don't see? And out of that grew something called the Wednesday evening program. Catchy phrase, I know. And so on Wednesday evenings, we always had a meal. We had arts and crafts. Maybe someone would come in and do yoga with the women. My daughter would come in and do makeovers. And this thing went on for 7 years that I was there. And we built up the volunteers because we said, what's your strength? What do you want to do? What do you feel comfortable doing? And so I encourage people to look at themselves and say, what am I really comfortable doing? What do I have to share? And there's always opportunity. If friends are listening, they're dying laughing because it was one of my catchphrases. There's always opportunity.
Well, and what you're saying is that almost anything, like if you crochet well, or if you're an artist, or if you're learning to play the ukulele, or if you're just good at massage, you could use any skill or hobby, gardening, and all of those things could lead.
Gardening was huge. We had a garden program. And what's interesting about these things is that it brings down the level of the place in a lower level of being in crisis or feeling in crisis. I mean, when Wednesday evening program was over, everybody went to bed feeling safe and connected. It was really a wonderful thing. And like you said, it can be anything that you're good at. We had one gentleman, he actually started his own program called HEAL, where he went into all of the children's hospitals and trauma centers. And so he would bring these fabulous arts and crafts supplies, like sequins, you know, as big as your wrist.
Oh.
And the women and children would do what I guess we would term art therapy. And they loved his coming every single week. And he was just such an encourager, his way of being. And so it can be something so simple that really shows these young people or these, you know, people that are incarcerated, I'm spending time with you.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I hope our listeners out there are reviewing all of their skills. And Lori, we wanted to ask you about the program tomorrow night, where it is, how you determined to bring up this wonderful speaker for us. Tell us a bit more, Lori.
Sure. So I want to start by giving a little bit of background on violence in our region, and then I'll give you a bit more information about why we're focusing on Native American women this year. And then some people will ask the question of why are the rates so high for Native American women? So I'll answer those questions and then give you a quick summary of the event itself.
Great.
Go ahead, sorry.
We don't have, what? How long do we have?
7 minutes, yeah.
Go for it, Lori.
all right, I wasn't sure if you would edit down what you want to use, so I can just directly answer your question then. So the event is on Tuesday, October 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at American Indian Hall on Montana State University's campus. You'll enter the building and find us in the central area. It's a beautiful building. We encourage everyone in the community to come out. If you're wondering how you can volunteer and contribute to try to solve some of these issues in our community, what I would say is come to these events. There's always something at MSU's campus for Indigenous Peoples Day. It will have been at noon after this program airs. There's also the annual event up on Pete's Hill for Indigenous Peoples Day, led by Mountain Time Arts at 5:30. And there is this event that happens on Tuesday. And if you miss those events, there's also an event on October 19th that Bozeman Health has also sponsored. Ivan and Ivy McDonald have created a documentary series that is called Murder in Bighorn, and it'll be screening with Extreme History Project at the Museum of the Rockies on the 19th in the evening, 5:30, I believe. So there are always opportunities to go attend events, and given the high proportion of people who are impacted by these issues that we've already discussed, you would be surprised going to these events, going to order a cup of coffee, going to a high school football game, going to a college basketball game. You will be rubbing shoulders with people who are directly impacted by all of the issues we've been discussing today. So I just encourage you to show up when we have these public events where everyone is welcome.
Lori. Go ahead, Karma.
I so appreciate this, Lori, because this is a way to get involved, to, you know, go to these cultural events. I say that to my students all the time that aren't Native. Start by going to cultural events. You know, it is, if you're nervous, it's the safest way for you to expose yourself to perhaps culture of people that you don't know very much about. And so I just amazing how much is being offered.
You guys have really been great. Is any area that we haven't, I'm sure there is, many areas we haven't covered. Is there any additional thing, Lori, that you'd like to add to what you just said?
I think that I do want to share that when we talked about the incarceration rate of Native American women being 6 times the rate of population in Montana, that is also associated, according to Dr. Luana Ross's work from 1998, and I can verify that these trends continue, that 90%, at least, if not all, incarcerated Native American women have experienced violence in their lives. Sarah Deer is another scholar that talks about the disproportionate rates of violence that Native American women have experienced. A conservative estimate says 1 in 3 Native American women experience rape in their lifetime. The CDC in 2010 said that it's probably closer to half. Sarah Deer has this really powerful quote where she describes the often unspoken experiences many Native American women experience. She says, "I listened to women as they realized they represented the 5th generation of women in their family to be victims of sexual assault, a realization that slowly emerged in a woman's eyes, casting a shadow across her face. This happened to Grandma when she was my age. No one helped her. She was always sad, and she never talked about it. Now I know the source of her sadness." And Sarah Deer is one of those activists that's also out working with Native women and also creating social change. She's an activist that in 2022 worked on the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act that has enabled tribal authorities to prosecute non-Native people for sexual violence, child abuse, and sex trafficking in reservation contexts. Scholars like Sarah, Karma, Luana Ross, and others are telling us kind of the background and the story of how we got to where we are and making a way forward for healing and also structural change that can change these patterns for our communities.
You all have presented invaluable information to the public via KGVM 95.9 and KGVM.org. We would urge all of you to listen to this program and others on those presentations. You can listen to them on Monday night at 7 and Thursday mornings at 9. And we've had 2 important, fantastic presenters today. And hopefully the public listening to this can attend some of these Indigenous Recognition Women's programs that you've mentioned and that are going to be presented here at Montana State. So, Gallatin Valley, thank you for listening. And listen to us. Go to kgvm.org, look at the past programs, listen to them. And we wish you a good evening.